To support our work at the Izzy and Murtada Picture Show and the work of other independent creators like us, sign up to listen to the podcast on Nebula.
Nebula is the creator-owned streaming platform that hosts great videos and podcasts like the one you're listening to now. Sign up today at nebula.tv/picture show and you will get access to this podcast plus other great podcasts and videos.
Sign up for Nebula and help support independent media creators. That's nebula.tv/picture show. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Izzy and Murtada Picture Show. It's Izzy this week. Murtada says hello. He loves all of you. Today, I am interviewing the one and only Dave Karger, TCM host, journalist extraordinaire, excellent writer who has just recently published the book, 50 Oscar Nights, Iconic Stars and Filmmakers on Their Career-Defining Wins. This book is available everywhere. It's a fantastic gift for anyone who loves the Oscars and film history and wants to hear about the really personal experiences that actors, directors, even some below the line creative individuals, how they experienced Oscar night. So without further ado, I won't keep you waiting. Here is my conversation with Dave Karger. Dave, thank you so much for being here. I'm so excited to talk to you. Well, first things first, tell listeners who might not already be aware of what the book is all about, what they can expect from 50 Oscar Nights.
Well, thank you. It's a book where I do new interviews with 50 Academy Award winners from 1962 all the way through 2019. So it's Rita Moreno, Mel Brooks, and Estelle Parsons, and Lee Grant, all the way through Meryl Streep, and Elton John, and Steven Spielberg, to Hannah Beekler, and Olivia Colman, and Allison Janney. So the idea behind the book was to do an Oscar book that came at the subject from a little bit more of a personal angle. So instead of looking at the Oscars through a lens of studio politics, I really wanted to conduct interviews that felt more intimate and emotional and give these 50 winners a space to tell stories that either they had never told before or not in such detail about what it was like for them to go through the whole experience of making the movie that they won their Oscar for and actually becoming an Oscar winner. So the interviews talk about the backstory of the project, but they really focus on the actual day of the Oscars, how the people were feeling, how they prepared, how they got ready, how they decided what to say, who to go with, what to wear in some cases, and how they partied and celebrated and where they keep their Oscar today and what it means to them all these years later.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I love about the angle of this book so much is how personal it makes these moments that feel so public feel like it's a day that I lived through versus the way we tend to think about things, which is like in a context or a career arc. But I'm curious, like when you were talking to a lot of these people, did you get a sense that they are really aware of the way other people talk about how they win? Like how aware are they of the public narrative that's generated about them?
Really interesting question. I think I probably would say it was different for each person. Like Hilary Swank told me something I never knew, that when she won her first Oscar for Boys Don't Cry, I guess there was some pushback. I don't know what the online community would have been like in the year 2000 when she won. But apparently there were people who were like, oh, she wasn't crying. She wasn't emotional. She obviously doesn't care. Like, in, so she even says in my interview with her, like, I couldn't even win for winning.
So that
was interesting to hear her talk about the negative feedback from her speech. I think it depends. I think some of these big stars are kind of in their own world in a way, and some of them are much more plugged in to, you know, the way that they're perceived. Certainly Barry Jenkins, for instance, I definitely get the sense that he was very much aware of all of the craziness surrounding his winning night for Moonlight. And I'm just so grateful that he actually tells the story from his point of view, basically for the first time in this book.
Yeah. Well, and that's another really interesting aspect too, is you have a lot of these A-listers whose Oscar stories are so well known, but then you also have a lot of people that readers may never have heard of, like you have sound mixers in here. And I'm wondering if there was anything you noticed about the differences between how very famous individuals and lesser known folks actually experience this process. Like, were there differences in their stories that kind of became obvious the more you talk to people of different levels of fame?
Yeah, I mean, I think for a lot of the people who are what we call below the line, they were very conscious of not wanting to take up too much time or be a burden on the people who were in the auditorium or watching on TV. Alan Menken was like, "Oh, I know nobody wants to hear from the composer, so I just went up there and tried to make my speech short." Or Mark Bridges, the costume designer who won the jet ski, at the, for giving him a 35-second speech. He goes, "So I know that nobody wants to hear from me." So that's really interesting to hear Alan Menken, who has more Oscars than anyone alive, literally, be telling me that he didn't want to give a speech that was too long. My favorite chapter in the whole book, to your point, is Kevin O'Connell, the sound mixer who finally won an Oscar for Hacksaw Ridge on his 21st nomination. He lost 20 times throughout the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. And he tells an amazingly beautiful story about what it's like to be the person clapping for someone else for 35 years and then finally win. And he won for best sound for Hacksaw Ridge over La La Land, which had won the Guild Award and the BAFTA. So no one expected he was going to win. So it was this big shock to everybody, and just a beautiful story.
Wow, that's incredible. And well, that's what I kind of like too, how comprehensive it is. It's comprehensive in terms of categories, but it's also comprehensive in terms of time. Like, you're the perfect person to write this book because, you know, obviously you have an association with TCM, but you've also been covering the Oscars for a while. And I'm curious, like, how you personally reflect on the Oscars, like, over time. I mean, how has it changed since the days you first started covering it to now?
So to explain to people, I started writing about the Oscars in 1997 when I was a young writer at Entertainment Weekly, and that was the year that four of the five Best Picture nominees were independent films. So it was The English Patient, Fargo, Shine, and Secrets and Lies, and only Jerry Maguire was a studio film. That was the first year I started writing about them. And then the next year, the Titanic year, was the first year I actually got to go to the Oscars. So I went 7 years in a row from the Titanic year through the Chicago year. So I was there for all of the like American Beauty, Gladiator, Beautiful Mind. And then I got to go the very first year it was held at the Dolby Theater. It was then called the Kodak Theater. So for those year, anything in the book that I is from 1997 or more recent, I felt like I had a personal connection to. And in fact, I had done the first big article on Hilary Swank for Boys Don't Cry at Entertainment Weekly. So that was exciting to then catch up with her again. Halle Berry, I actually spent 2 days on the set of Monsters Ball in Louisiana in the summer of 2001 for Entertainment Weekly, and got to watch her partially shoot the movie and interview her in her trailer. And even then, the crew was saying, "Watch out for this performance. It's pretty special." And even though we had this great moment together and I wrote a cover story on her, she sent me flowers when it came out, which no
Oh
one
my
ever does.
gosh.
I've not seen her or talked to her in 22 years until we got on Zoom together last year for this book. So that was so exciting and special to reunite with her and to kind of reminisce about the tiny little part that I got to play in, her whole journey. But I also want to say, not for nothing, Izzy, that for some of the older winners, I'll tell you what was really helpful: Be Kind Rewind.
Hey, well, thank you. Thank you.
You have a great video on Sally Field. You have a great video on Lee Grant. You have a great video on Sissy Spacek. And besides just being a delight to watch and listen to, and so interesting, they were really helpful to me as I was preparing for those three interviews in particular. So thank you
Oh,
for all
oh
your
my
work.
God. Thank you. I'm not doing this in vain now. I feel like I'm helping. That's
True,
great. Thank God. Oh,
true.
so good to hear. Well, thank you. Well, I mean, it must also be true though that so many of the people that you talk to have been doing this for decades as well, right? Like, you've been paying very close attention and like personal attention because you've been there. But someone like Meryl Streep's been going to the Oscars since the 70s, you know, when the ceremony was a little more low key, let's say. did you get a sense from talking to them or people who've been going for decades, whether there's kind of a sense of nostalgia maybe for when the ceremony used to be a little easier or a little less fraught?
Like, for instance, yes, when it had charm. But a lot of the winners that I talked to from the early 80s and before, this one through line that was hilarious, and this is not a fashion book, okay? I do ask a couple of the people who have interesting outfits about what they wore, but this is not a fashion book. But to hear Meryl Streep say that in 1983, she had to go to the basement sale rack of Saks to find a dress, or Lee Grant went to a used dress store and got someone's old wedding dress, or Estelle Parsons spent $30 to find a dress on the Upper West Side, or Mel Brooks rented a tuxedo to go to the Oscars. There, it did have this charm to it in the 60s, 70s, and early 80s, before the armies of not only stylists, but consultants, you know, the whole Weinstein Company of it all, Miramax of it all, who really changed the game. And there's some good that came out of that, because I really do think that the Oscars really helped elevate independent film in a way that they wouldn't have, arguably, without the armies of highly paid consultants who were doing all their work. So there's positive and, of course, a lot of negative to all of that. But yes, that was part of the joy of this book, was to talk to some of these people. And there's six people in the book who are old, over the age of 90. And there's people who won in the 60s and 70s, as I said. So to hear their stories about back when it was a simpler time, and it was just basically the Golden Globes, the New York Film Critics, and the Oscars, and that was it. It didn't have this sense of inevitability like it used to. There could be more true surprises.
Right. It's kind of the Oscars have kind of turned into like the exclamation point of a very rigorous, lengthy season. I mean, how do you think that's changed how audiences think about the Oscars? And do like actors and directors think about them differently now?
I think that's the problem. I think it's become a slog. Now, listen, I am still an Oscar fanatic. I can't wait for the Oscars every year. It's going to be great. But as you say, I wouldn't even say it's an exclamation point. What punctuation is like a whimper, just like an ellipsis.
Just like a deflating balloon.
It is. I mean, I feel like I already know who won, who's going to win. We all do, right?
Yeah.
So that's why I'm counting on, you know, Jimmy Kimmel to be the fabulous host that he always is. But yeah, I mean, I kind of wish we could return to the day. I love going to the Critics' Choice Awards. It's super fun. Mm-hmm. But I wish we could almost return to the day where there was not 5,000 other shows, and that we could have some surprises. I don't know if that's that.
Yeah. What's the last real surprise? Maybe Olivia Colman?
Yeah, Colman. That's why.
But you talked to her as well.
I did. I had to. She's the most recent winner in the book. And I knew I needed, first of all, I just love her. I love her as a person. I'm just a huge fan of hers. I think she's always doing something very interesting. And as you recall, even though she had won the BAFTA for The Favorite, everyone thought Glenn Close was going to win for The Wife. And her speech that year was just rollicking. And it was veered from funny to sad to hilarious to weird to rambling to emotional. And that's why I knew I had to have her in the book. And she was a great interview. All the Brits are so fabulous.
Right. Do you have like a fantasy list of people from classic Hollywood that you wish you could have interviewed for this book?
Yeah, I mean, there were some that I reached out to that I found out just really aren't doing that many interviews these days. So I tried for Julie Andrews. I tried for Shirley Jones. I tried for Eva Marie Saint. Of course, I tried for Barbara Streisand, but she was writing her own book.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, out of people who are no longer with us, sure. If that book, it would have Hattie McDaniel in it. It would have Gary Cooper in it. Of course, it would have Joan Crawford, although she didn't go to the Oscars the year that she won. She was
well. That's why you have to ask. Were you sick? First question.
Betty Davis, Katharine Hepburn. I mean, there's Katharine Hepburn never went. Paul Newman. There's a lot of people I would have loved to have interviewed for. John Gielgud also didn't go. Mm-hmm. But for the book, it needed to be people who went, because it just wouldn't have been the same, because the book is also, it does have archival pictures in it. And if someone just sat at home and found out that they won, it just wouldn't have really worked for them.
Jones really is the only, Joan Crawford is really the only at home picture that has any merit to it, huh?
It would be pretty great.
Yeah. So did having conversations with 50 winners change how you observed Oscar season this year? Like just having these people in your mind as you observe the campaigns going on.
It kind of did, because to your point, I am still interviewing current nominees. Like I just right. went to the Oscar nominees lunch for TCM and interviewed a lot of them. I think what this whole process taught me and reminded me is that just because someone's nominated for an Oscar or about to win one doesn't necessarily mean that everything in their life is great. It's not all the Cinderella moment. And chapters in this book, interviews in this book, like Nicole Kidman or Marley Matlin or Sally Field or Barry Jenkins mm-hmm. or Mira Sorvino, can show us all that these people, even though they're megastars in some cases and at the height of their very high profile profession, they're still going through very human challenges, crises, if you will, at times. And it's a reminder to me, which I hope I already knew, and I mm-hmm. hope it's the way I conduct myself already, just to be gentle with people. Right. Even if they're in this very exciting position. I mean, it's a slog, as I said, especially now. And I, you know, look at Davine Joy Randolph, bless her heart. She's just been for months now, and she made this movie 2+ years ago. And, you know, she must just be like, I cannot talk about this woman, Mary, this character anymore. She just must be so old. But she's doing it, and she's going to win an Oscar, and it's going to be a really exciting moment. But it's just a long process, folks.
Yeah, I think that's a really good thing to kind of keep in mind, too. I mean, one of the things that really surprised me about interviews with actors often is like someone will make them aware of what everybody is saying about them online in real time. And that's always kind of like bizarre to me, because like they usually have no idea. I don't know if you saw the most recent one about Dakota Johnson, where they were like, oh, did you see everyone memed this from Madam Web? And she's like, what?
Right.
And I just feel like that kind of thing happens all the time with the Oscars. Like, is someone going to go up to Bradley Cooper and be like, everyone is making fun of you online? Like, does that happen? Or
I know,
I have no idea.
At what point is it then his publicist's job to let him know? And by the way, I think it's so unfair the way people have been treating
right.
you. Man is a true artist, and doing all of this for the sake of creating art. And it just upsets me to see people pile on him because he's so earnest. God forbid he be earnest.
Right. Yeah. It has gotten a little extreme, in my opinion. But that's what I think is so great to your point about your book is like, this man is just living his life and probably has no idea that anyone is even developing right. this other conversation about him.
I hope not, for his yeah. sake, because I can't, I mean, even from my very minor point of view now on TCM, where people want to, you know, tweet me if they don't like something that I do or say. And it's hard. And I read it all. I mean, I'm sure mm-hmm. Nicole Kidman is not reading the comments on her Instagram, but I do read it because I don't get the volume that she gets.
Right.
But it just as a human being, it has an effect on me.
Yeah.
And I can, it must have an effect on people who find out about it. Julia Roberts even spoke openly about it. She posted a picture of her, I guess, playing chess with her niece or something. And everyone kind of commented on the fact they didn't think that she looked good. And she just kind of brought to everyone's attention that this really hurt her feelings. So it shows, it doesn't matter who you are, you still have feelings.
Totally. And you've already mentioned a couple of them, but I feel like there were so many moments of this book where I was just like, wow, I can't even believe people are being that honest or open about what they were thinking about on that day. Was there a particular wow moment for you where you were like, oh man, that's huge. Can't believe this person said that.
Yeah. The whole Jane Fonda interview was a wow moment for me, just to hear her speak so openly about how she felt like Hollywood, the community at large, was very hostile towards her because of what they might have perceived as her radical political views, and that she thought that she was going to get booed when she got up there to accept her Oscar. That was kind of shocking. Sally Field's whole interview was really fascinating, about the fact she was dating Burt Reynolds and he was so unsupportive of her. And the movie got into Cannes, Norma Rae, and she said, I'm going to go to Cannes. And his response was, well, you don't think you're going to win anything, do you? That was shocking
Yikes.
To me.
Yeah.
So there, and the fact that these people remember all this, you know, 40, 50 years later, shows, in my mind, how indelible these memories are for a lot of these people and how meaningful it was in a positive or a negative way, these things that people said to them.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the Oscars generally, and you've been there on the red carpet, what is something that you think people at home don't know, maybe, but should know about what the red carpet is like?
It definitely has an electricity to it that's unlike anything. I mean, the thing about the Oscars is that it, compared to the Golden Globes, there's not actually as many famous people at the Oscars.
Oh,
as
really?
You go to the Golden Globes and you're in that room and it's just like everywhere you look, it's like it's a wildly famous person. The Oscars is different because there's fewer categories that have celebrities in them. And then there's so many seats for just regular kind of rank and file Oscar voters. And so it doesn't have that everywhere you look, there's a mega celebrity thing like the Golden Globes does. But there is, it's the Oscars, it's the ultimate. So it is overwhelming, especially I remember the year that I co-hosted the red carpet show was the year of Darkest Hour and I, Tonya. So I remember when Gary Oldman or Allison Janney walked on, it was just like everyone's eyes just went towards them and they were being pulled in 10 different directions. It's a lot for these people to, I can only imagine how hard it would be to not be overwhelmed by it and to try to stay present in the moment. And I remember interviewing Gary Oldman and thinking that he did a really good job because people were just throwing stuff his way, you know, shouting questions and everything, but he was a real trooper.
Are you guaranteed time on the carpet or do people kind of pick and choose who they want to talk to in the moment?
So when I've done it, the only times that I've actually worked the Oscars carpet, I was either the red carpet greeter, which was, that's the person who gets to actually interview the people over the loudspeaker in front of fans, or I was co-hosting the official ABC red carpet show. So for both of those cases, you pretty much get who you want. But no, by all means, if I had been covering for Entertainment Weekly, I never did that, but I was always inside the show. But if I was the red carpet person for Entertainment Weekly, I would be in no way guaranteed to get anybody. I would have to then rely on my relationships with the actors or the publicists and try to get them to come over. But the beauty of being the greeter the years that I did it is that because you have the microphone over the loudspeaker, you can shame anyone into coming and talking to you. I remember the one year, it was the year that Sandra Bullock won, and she was coming, and maybe she was going to come to me anyway, I don't know, but I saw her coming down the carpet and I said, look, ladies and gentlemen, nominated for best actress, it's Sandra Bullock. And everyone started applauding. And I remember saying, do you think she should come talk to me? And everyone said, yeah. She had no choice because I shamed her into doing it.
Right.
But that's the beauty. You're the only person with the megaphone, essentially. Yeah.
You've got an audience.
It was wonderful.
There you go.
Wonderful.
I feel like the Oscars are going through a little bit of a identity crisis, maybe, in a couple of different ways. There's always talk about how to make the ceremony kind of more appealing to the general viewer. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about how the efforts they've made to do that and any suggestions or would love to see kind of ideas that you have for innovations.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that the Academy will not let ABC do a telecast without including each and every category. And again, compared to the Golden Globes, where the vast majority of categories have famous people in them, the majority of Oscar categories don't. So that's the push and pull. I do think that with the advent of 10 Best Picture nominees, it's created a situation whereby big movies are now more likely to be nominated. Look at Barbie and Oppenheimer. I think that's actually going to increase the viewership, and the fact that Billie Eilish is going to sing and then Ryan Gosling is going to sing, I think that's going to help. I think Jimmy Kimmel's a great host and he's going to do everything he can. This might be a popular opinion with some people, or it might not, but my whole thing is I think they should get rid of the short film categories at the Oscars and have a separate short film Academy Awards ceremony on a different day or the day before or something. The fact of the matter is The vast, vast majority of people do not know what these short films are. I would argue the quality of the short films that have been nominated over the past few years has not been very good. So that would be my thing, and get rid of three categories right there. And then that would at least streamline, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes out of the telecast. Not a big difference, but it would do something. The thing I would hate to see is if one day the Academy goes down the Golden Globe route and does a, you know, box office category.
Or right.
Thank God they didn't do that popular film category or a comedy category. I just think anything like that would be pandering to me, and the need to stay the course and be the be all end all, the ultimate, the most prestigious. And the only way they can really do that is staying true to the traditions.
Right. Well, I think it's tough because it's that tension between wanting to streamline it, but also acknowledging that the categories aren't necessarily comprehensive or reflective of all of the work that goes into film. Like they're adding the casting category. Are there any categories that you'd like to see added, maybe?
I mean, I've heard people advocating for a stunt category.
Yep.
That would be cool, I guess. But not every movie has stunts, but then not every movie has visual effects. So there's a visual effects category. I don't know. I'm not really one of these people who is clamoring for more categories at the Oscars.
Yeah. What do you think about doing you know how there's kind of like a daytime arts Emmy or like a technical ceremony that's separate? Because they have the one for the Governor Awards, right?
And at the Emmys, they have the Creative Arts Emmys, because there's so many Emmy categories. They save all the big ones for the primetime show. I think that would be a great idea, but the Academy will never allow that. Not anytime soon, but that's a brilliant idea. And then just for the actual Oscar ceremony, have it be a 2-hour show, or and have it just be picture director, the screenplay categories, the music categories, and the acting categories, for instance. And then do everything else, all the below the line stuff at a, you know, another ceremony earlier in the day. That's the way the Tonys do it as well.
Yeah. I think so. That kind of addresses what the Academy's role is, I guess, and television's role in ensuring the future of the Oscars and the audience interest in the Oscars. But I think there's also the audience itself, right? Like, I think the Oscars feel very divisive. A lot of very dedicated cinephiles don't think, well, you know, it's not actual best film of the year, so why should I pay attention to it? And then other people, you know, play it like a game. Like, there's a lot of different ways to kind of think about the Oscars. And I'm curious who you think, like, who is this ceremony for in terms of when you're airing it on TV? Who's the main audience, and like, what does it do for them?
Do you know who it's for? Everybody.
Yeah.
I think it's just the way the Super Bowl is for everybody. This is the entertainment Super Bowl. And I think that's the beauty of it, because you can interact with the Oscars in so many different ways, as you've just spelled out. Mm-hmm. You can hate watch it. You can watch it for the fashion. You can watch it for the speeches. You can watch it as a competition with your friends. You can kind of half watch it at a party. There's so many different ways that you can interact with it. But the fact of the matter is that I really do think, just, and also talking to the Academy members that I know, they treat it so seriously, the actual voting and the watching of the films and the judging of it. And yes, of course, it's weird to say who's better, Emma Stone and Poor Things or Lily Gladstone and Killers of the Flower Moon. It's weird.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I also know that these people take it very seriously, and it's exciting. And even though the ratings are never going to be what they were in the 80s or 90s, it's still going to be probably the highest rated non-sports TV telecast of the year, as it most often is. So, and I, of course, like you, I've heard people say the Oscars aren't relevant anymore. No one cares about the Oscars. But look what happened this year when Greta Gerwig and Margot Robbie were not nominated in their two marquee categories. It was the talk of the world for that couple mm-hmm. days. If that's not relevance, I don't know what is.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So who are you rooting for this year? Any big ones? Maybe not who's going to win, but are you allowed to say? Is this like a journalistic problem?
If I had a vote, I'd be voting for like Anatomy of a Fall across the board. I just love that movie so much. I think it's brilliant. I also, I'm a bit of an apologist for Maestro. I think Maestro's great. I thought it was beautifully done. If I had a vote, it would be Bradley Cooper for best actor. I think what
There you
he did
go.
was incredible. Actress would be hard because it's Carey Mulligan, but it's also Sandra Buller, who is just so fabulous.
Yeah, she'd be mine, I think. She'd be my vote.
And then, of course, I'm rooting for Billie Eilish because I think that song from Barbie is gorgeous, and I know she'll win, and that'll be great.
Yeah. One question from Murtada that I think is really interesting. So he was talking about how Jack Nicholson used to be kind of the Oscars king. Like he was always center stage, front row, playing up for the cameras. Who is that person now? Like, do we have an ever-present A-lister who's just kind of mugging it up? Or who
That's a
should
great
it be?
question. I know. Well, the thing is, what's interesting is that you have a class of people. George Clooney once told me, total name
As one
dropper,
says, of course.
said to me that he will never go to the Oscars unless he's a nominee. He
Right.
says every year they ask him to go as a presenter or, to show up or whatever, and he won't go. He thinks it's kind of like he thinks you only go to the Oscars if you're a nominee. That actually makes perfect sense. Now, Jack Nicholson may also have only ever been there when he was a nominee, but because he's been nominated so many times, he's always there. We'll have to go back and see.
Yeah.
I think that's many people's kind of prevailing opinion. Like you accept an Oscar presenter slot if you're Glenn Powell and you're amazing and your career is rising and it's a great thing. Or Penelope Cruz, before she was ever nominated, she would go and present. But I feel like a lot of the really established people feel like it's uncouth now to go to the Oscars as a big star, unless you're an actual nominee. So you
Right.
don't see Julia Roberts doesn't just show up at the Oscars.
Right. And I feel like,
Now,
isn't it hard to get an invite anyway? Like, even if you're in some of these movies.
yes, it is. It is hard, but what's interesting is that, as I'm sure you know, now this year they're going back to that cool thing where for each of the acting categories, they're going to have five people who have won in that category before to come back and present. So that's cool.
Yeah,
So
I
I
love
think maybe
that.
that's exceptions. So maybe if like they went to Forest Whitaker and said, we're going to have five Best Actor winners come back, would you be one of them? I think he's more likely than to say yes than if he was just going to present a random category on his own. So that's a great question, though, Murtada. I wish I had like the perfect answer for you, like who should be the perennial Oscar attendee. I just don't think that's going to happen anymore because tickets
Yeah.
are scarce and people don't want to feel like they're just mugging for attention.
Well, I also feel like there's a difference in the way we think about actors now. I think it's very hard to become a movie star now. You know, do you have
Sure.
any thoughts on that? The changing nature of the way we think
Sure.
about these actors and directors?
I remember just even in the, so I worked at Entertainment Weekly for 17 years. I was there from 1995 until 2012. And even just in the 17 years that I was at that magazine, it was fascinating for me to see the evolution, the change in the actual cover images that we did. So when I started at EW in the mid 90s, it was movie star time. It was Matthew McConaughey on the cover and Julia Roberts on the cover and Jim Carrey on the cover in these really cool portrait shots of them as themselves. By the time I left that magazine, what sold and what people wanted to see on the cover was Robert Downey Jr. in character as Iron Man
Right.
or Spider-Man. Didn't even matter who it was, the Spider-Man mask or something. And what happened was in that 17 years, at least that I was covering entertainment on a weekly basis as a journalist, it went from the stars being the stars, the actors being the stars, to the characters being the stars and the franchise being the stars. I mean, did we ever put Daniel Radcliffe on the cover of EW where he wasn't Harry Potter? I don't know if we ever did.
Wow.
So
Yeah.
I think that's been the big change. I don't like that change because I'm not someone who cares by and large about franchise movies. It's just not what I'm interested in,
Right.
Event Spider-Man, Dune. It's just not my thing. I'm more interested in Anatomy of a Fall or Maestro or
Yeah.
Oppenheimer. So that's troubling to me that, I mean, if there was a poll that came out of like people's favorite movie stars, and they were all, with the exception of Chris Hemsworth, over the age of 40. And that just
Yeah,
goes to
it's
show, it
startling.
shows me that it's hard for these people to break through. Even someone, I mean, I mentioned Glenn Powell. I think he's a very exciting movie star, but a lot of people probably don't even know who he is.
So true. Something I was thinking about with that movie stars being over 40. One of the stats that kind of astonished me was that Annette Bening and Emma Stone like have the same number of Best Actress nominations at this point. And how it's sort of like I'm thinking about a generation below 40 who seem like they're going to have a different approach to longevity that some of these older actresses weren't necessarily afforded like consistently. It's like some of them are coming back now and like get their Oscar moment, like Annette Bening, but it wasn't like she was getting them over and over and over again throughout her career, you know? So
No.
I think that's really interesting too, thinking about this like young generation, like the Jennifer Lawrence g generation that's just kind of, I think, going to rack up so many over their lifetimes.
Right. And compare that to the interview in my book with Lee Grant, where she won her Oscar at age 49 and told me that she remembers walking up to accept her Oscar and being like, oh, well, that's probably the end of my acting career. I'm 49. And isn't it amazing that people like Cate Blanchett and Laura Linney and Meryl Streep and Helen Mirren and all these other people are proving that you can have a fantastic career into your 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Absolutely. Yeah. Have you seen all the Death Becomes Her things coming out recently? Like, because they're making a musical of it. And so
Right?
people are kind of circulating clips and stuff. And it just occurred to me, like, watching Meryl Streep and Goldie Hawn being like, we're so old. I'm like, you guys look amazing. Just the
Different
way it's
time.
changed so much. Yeah. Okay. Well, we're approaching our time. So, where can people buy the book? Where can people find you? What's coming up next for you?
The book is everywhere. You can get books. Of course, I'm encouraging people to go to independent bookstores because I love supporting that. But you can also very easily get it on Amazon or barnesandnoble.com or target.com. It's anywhere you can find a book. I am on X, formerly known as Twitter, and Instagram at Dave Karger, Karger. And we have some cool stuff coming up on TCM on April 14th. It's the 30th birthday of TCM. So all day long, we're going to be showing some old introductions that our original host Robert Osborne did, including one that I got to co-host with Robert Osborne back in 2007. So 17 years ago, you get to see like a little baby Dave being chatted up by Robert Osborne. And then our TCM Film Festival is in the middle of April, so I'm looking forward to that. But it's things are kind of thankfully winding down. I don't have to talk about Oppenheimer and Barbie anymore.
After March 10th. After March 10th.
Exactly.
All right, good. Well, thank you so much, Dave. I really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. Great to see you, Izzy.